The views presented in this program may not reflect the views of the University of Connecticut, WHUS Radio, or the staff of the station.
To keep working, with us for our students. So I think that the more that we can start going back to my question, this question of who am I missing at the table? What am I doing for our students of color? What stories am I listening from our students of color? And what stories am I listening? I'm not listening from, from our students as well. And I think that imposter syndrome and sense of belonging is needed for every single college student, but certainly is more prevalent for our students of color. And I will stop.
Welcome back to In the Middle of Somewhere. I'm your host, Joe Vasquez. So I want to apologize for a bit of the production delay on my end in terms of getting everything set up. Everything should be fixed going forward, so all episodes will be available to stream on Spotify and on the Apple Podcast app. So I'm here, and I'm very excited to be here with all of you today. So we're going to get into something that I feel gets more important as we get deeper into the school year and as more people get more consumed within their work. Now, have you ever questioned your place in a space or maybe held back from applying because you didn't think you were qualified? I want to let you know that is a completely normal feeling and it's okay. So, imposter syndrome can be described as a state of insecurity and self-doubt about one's ability. Oftentimes, you can be questioning whether or not you're good enough to be in a certain space. So, by believing that you do not deserve the success that you may have already earned. So I'm really unsure when this episode will go live, but November 8th marks the National First Generation College Student Celebration Day. Whoa, that was a lot. So as a first generation student myself, I find it really important to take a moment and take pride in the work that you have done and how far you have come. Because I really think a lot of the times throughout life, we get so overwhelmed with what we don't have or what we're working for rather than accepting our own achievements. And I think it can be really easy to feel like you don't belong in a space given some of these areas that you're in, such as education or maybe labor force, can provoke this type of sort of competitive nature. Today, I'll be sitting with someone very dear to me and who has helped shape my college experience and navigated my experiences with imposter syndrome. That person is Fani De Jesus Hannon, who is the current director of the Puerto Rican Latin American Cultural Center at the University of Connecticut. For those of you who do not know, that is located on the fourth floor of the Student Union. I wanted to ask Fani what she thought of the term imposter syndrome, how we can support our peers, and kind of gain more of a perspective from her own experience. So I hope you enjoy. So tell me, who is Fani?
So thank you. Thank you so much, Joe, for having me on your program. I'm looking forward to have this conversation. I also have my cup of coffee, because coffee has always, defined who is Fani. It's very interesting you're asking me this question, because I've been talking a lot about my origins for the last 2 weeks. So Fani was born and raised in Choluteca, Honduras, and since I don't hide my age, so 45 years ago, I just had my birthday a few weeks back. So I was born in Choluteca, Honduras. We don't really hear much of the Central American immigration, but I came with my family to the U.S. in 1996, and I was 20 years old. So I came from a family that being a family. So I'm very blessed to have a mom and dad that have always been invested in my life and the life of my sisters. I have three sisters. I'm the oldest. So one of the interesting things about me is that education has always been present in my life, and it has always really defined, or who knows, maybe, I had a defined education, but in my own way. So I love sewing. It's one of my I love sewing. I love baking and cooking. I love gardening a lot. I enjoy it. I also love reading and love coffee. I have, this heating love for pets, specifically beagles. I have a beagle, her name is Stella. And I have an African gray. His name is Zazu. So he speaks more Spanish than my lovely husband. And I also love cats. But I think that what defines me is that I love people. I love connecting with people. But there's one specific group of people that I love, and certainly that is college students, no questions asked. I love getting to know the Huskies. I love working at UConn. And certainly, you know, like my 8 years as a director of the Puerto Rican Latin American Culture Center had been one of the, you know, the best years in my professional career. So I'm very blessed. I love nature, and I love taking walks and meditate and really, you know, asking those profound questions like the one you just asked. Who am I and what's my purpose in this life? But I'm gonna stop there.
For me, I think it's crazy because I've been getting more into the idea of like taking care of my own social well-being, and I've gotten really into mindfulness and really reflecting on myself and having those conversations with myself and really thinking about like where I'm at in life or how I kind of react to certain situations, which I think has been huge for me in terms of growth and I guess own healing, not to toot my horn, but like I wanted to ask you, how would you describe imposter syndrome?
I think that for me, the way that I define imposter syndrome is not, it's hiding who I am, in all honesty, Joe. It's hiding my personality. It's hiding from what makes funny, right? So, you asked me, okay, who is funny? And it's also for me, imposter syndrome is not be true to myself and having those insecurities, having those doubts, feeling that I don't belong, right? And certainly you and I can talk a little bit more about sense of belonging, because I see imposter syndrome and sense of belonging going hand by hand. But going back, to your question and how do I define imposter syndrome is really deny who I am. And I had been in situations where I had, I felt that I needed to hide who Fanny was, my voice, the way that I speak, the way that I move my hands. So yeah, it's really feeling that, having all of these different doubts and insecurities. Mm.
That's sort of that experience right there with all these doubts and insecurities. It reminds me of, while doing, looking more into imposter syndrome, I found that something that goes hand in hand with imposter syndrome is something called stereotype threat, which is something what you just sort of mentioned right there, which is basically a situational predicament in which people are or feel themselves to be at risk of conforming to a stereotype about their social group. Now that specifically like really stood out to me, because I think when we look at imposter syndrome or sense of belonging with, you know, our Huskies or students on campus, it's, at least for me, I've heard within my friends trying to, like, I don't want to conform to a stereotype. I don't want to have to do this, or I don't want to come off this way in a class so they don't look at me this way. Or I don't want to come off as the angry minority in this space because I'm upset. So how do you think this sort of, like, stereotype threat or even imposter syndrome to, like, kind of bounce off, like, how do you think that plays a role in affecting our students?
You know, I think that... So as I was listening to what you were saying about, stereotype threat, I think it's so important to really understand why people have to hide who they are, right? So, okay, so let's unpack that, a little bit, because if we go to environments that we don't see people that look like us, or we cannot be who we are, because we're still are moving into environments that they were not built for us. And I promise you, I'm going to land pretty soon with my metaphor. So, and I'm going to use myself as an example. I think that I come from a family that we were, to this day, very united. And I decided to go to college, to Smith College. 3 best years of my life. I got a full scholarship, and I'm very grateful for the education I had had at Smith. But I remembered feeling, out of place. And I think that it's so interesting, because we don't really now, after so many years of reflection and after so many years of understanding who I am, I can certainly tell you that I suffered of imposter syndrome when I was at Smith. And one of the major pieces was my accent. So I still have an accent and I love my accent. It's part of who I am. It's part of my linguistic capital. But I went to an environment that even though I have people who believed in me, back at Smith, I had two amazing professors and an amazing group of women who really thought that Fanny would make it here. But at the same time, the environment was not conducive for my success. So, you know, with going back to my accent, I will never forget, I had a classmate that we were housemates to. We were taking the same class, and she could not believe that I had, you know, earned an 8 in the first exam. And her belief was, how was this possible that you got an 8 when English is not your first language? And oh my God, the book that we're reading is so hard. Probably, I'm going to tell you this, probably have taken me more time to be in the library. But I remember feeling so alone, because even though my friends believed in me, I didn't have anyone at Smith that I could have gone and talked about these things and said, this is what is happening to me. I'm feeling, you know, alone. So I think that is so important, you know, for, I wish now obviously Smith, you know, has resources, but I wish during my time at Smith that it would have been a resource, you know, on campus that we could have definitely talked about and named these things, and because I didn't have it at that time. But to this day, that is something that it affected me, but at the same time, it gave me the push to say, no, I'm not going to be embarrassed the way that's, you know, I speak English. English is one of the hardest languages, in my own opinion. But at the same time, it takes time, you know? And I think that specifically, you know, imposter syndrome affects everyone. But I think that we need to be very real to ourselves. Imposter syndrome affects even more our students of color or students coming from marginalized identities. And when we have our institutions that they are not, they're not creating the resources, but also it's also creating the environment for you to be successful, for you to feel that you belong, then we're definitely failing our students to feel that they're going to constantly feel that they need to prove themselves, you know, and it shouldn't be that way.
I think that kind of connects to, I think, how we can see support. Like, how does support look like on campuses? Because I think the biggest thing is what you mentioned is like having that group of resources or having those resources available. I think the biggest thing that can really help a lot of people is being able to connect with people with similar experiences to kind of contextualize what they're going through and not be able to say like, I'm feeling alone in this situation. Because even hearing you within your story, it really reminds me of a lot of myself throughout high school. Like, I had a lot of like friends, quote unquote, or people in my life that would really doubt my abilities and whether I was taking my AP classes, of whether I was going to college. I remember specifically, like, I was told that I got into UConn Storrs campus and got the 8 I did because they needed like to fill a certain racial quota. And this person in context got like admitted to UConn Hartford, and they were a white student. And they were using this form to like contextualize their anger against me by saying, you know, I was undeserving of my spot because I'm getting it for a racial quota. Again, trying to connect it back as much as possible. Like, I think what I really enjoyed from taking your class was looking at like the cultural wealth model, is really looking at the ways that we're able to utilize our capitals for success and how that is sort of our resources that makes us marketable. And a lot, I think, now is like with familial and social capital, which are huge for me, I think, when it comes to this topic, because you're able to draw on your social and personal, like, essentially human resources that you had prior to college. And now with when you come into college and you're able to bring them into one place. And now I think like my first experience with imposter syndrome coming into college was my freshman year. I took an urban and community studies class. I'm an urban community studies major in human rights, but like this is my first intro class. And we were learning about food insecurity. We were learning about housing insecurity. We were learning about poverty. And the documentaries we were watching made everything feel, you know, very real. It contextualized a lot of the things we were learning. But I think when I was sitting in that classroom, I definitely felt different from a lot of my peers, because it's like, I lived through this. I lived through a lot of the things that we were learning about. It's like, I didn't really know the terminology behind some of these things. Well, I guess I was food insecure, or I guess we didn't have adequate housing at this time. And it's really different, because it's like when we were going into our first, one of our first group projects was trying to design like a city or design something. And I had a group member who like, who in a way was a little like resilient to the way that I wanted to develop a city to like provide a little bit more for our downtown area. And it's that little situation, obviously it wasn't much in the moment, but it's like removing myself from that. It's like, I don't know how many other people sit in the front of their classroom and think like, wow, that's my life on those PowerPoint slides. Like, that's my family that I'm thinking about. And it's always like, I always feel so guilty after too, because it's like, I'm visiting my family and like I'm seeing my family and it's like, this is still, you know, a reality, or this is still like their experiences, and I'm over here in college trying to be better, do better. And it really plays into like, do I actually belong here? Should I still be enrolled? Should I be doing something more with my time to utilize it? And I think those conversations are just so natural, like among our students, that it just becomes sort of a normalized feeling, and there's no ways for our students to learn how to get themselves out of those ruts, or like ensuring that they go to the right resources so they know that they are not alone.
No, and I agree with you, Joe, because I think as you were talking, right? So, and I remember that when you were taking, the urban class in your first year. So I'm so proud of you and seeing you where you are, you know, the man that you are becoming. So I'm very proud of you. That's the commercial, the PSA. But one of the pieces that as you were talking, I think that for our underrepresented group of students and students with, you know, with different social identities. So life becomes a reality. And I think that, you know, to your point, when you are in the classroom and learning about, you know, different things, but for some of us, that is a reality, right? So that is still a reality of food insecurity, house affordability. And then for many of us to feel that, wow, oh my God, I'm in college and I'm making it. And you and I know this, that as Latinx, our victories is not only ours, it's the entire family and the extended family and the extended community. So one of the pieces that I really hope in my fulfilling my purpose in this life is that I will definitely feel that in higher education, we are turning the page when students from underrepresented groups would feel that they definitely belong in the universities. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is that, you know, at universities like UConn, we are very privileged that we have culture centers for our students. And I think that's fantastic. Without the struggle, la lucha, the fight for this underrepresented group of students, in our case, right? For Puerto Rican students, Eno, Ana Maria, Isabel, and Bruni. And, you know, I love to name them because they were real. They are real. They're the ones who fought for us. But I think that my dream, as I keep envisioning myself as a higher education administrator, is to really have sense of belonging that our students of color feel that they belong in every single aspect of the university, that you don't have to justify your existence to anybody, that you can be who you are and that you can express your whole self, not only in the culture centers, but in every single aspect of the university, that you can express yourself in the classroom, that you can express yourself in your lab, in your residence hall, in the dining halls, right? And how are we going to do that? Yes, you know, I think that having food that reflects your culture, your having specifically authors or scholars that, and nowadays in 2020, as bad as this year has been, Joe, I have great news for you. We have outstanding, I mean, scholars of color who have been writing amazing work in at all, I mean, disciplines. It's not only the social studies or urban studies, it's all the disciplines, chemistry, bio, and you name it. And I think that the more we start changing our ideology as a higher education, right? So, and if we start, you have been learning and myself as well, that decolonizing, right? So you know, I love reflection. As you know, I have a lot of journals and I like to write and I like to reflect a lot. So I started really thinking about, okay, so what people mean by decolonizing? And I think that given to my own philosophy as well, is to really start looking at higher education based on the demographics that we have. Our students, students in college are changing. And I think that the time has come that we are definitely now looking at higher education from a different lens. I think that higher education, specifically in this country, was funded by white males and for white males, right? And I think that now things have changed and have progressed in a way that we need to ask these questions and reflect. So how are we doing, you know, how do we are proposing learning? Because I think that all of that needs to change. We need to really look at the demographics that are entering to all the colleges and universities in the United States and really ask, I mean, this question, who are we missing from, you know, from the curriculum? What are we missing? I mean, so our students can feel that they belong and that they don't feel as an imposter. And I think that at the moment that we start making those points, Joe, I can guarantee you that we will definitely start seeing true change in specifically, you know, in our underrepresented students, and as well seeing, you know, like that being inclusive, that you know, equity, diverse, all of these terms, right, that we use are being seen in every single aspect of the university. That is not only in your home away from home, right? As a culture center, that are, and that's my dream. That is what I am aspire to contribute to higher education in, because I love this field. This is my vocation, but that is my dream, that we can start really being intentional and changing how do we work. From a lens of inclusivity, but also from a lens taking into consideration, you know, the demographics that we have.
I think inclusivity and intentionality have been like the biggest shifts in the field of diversity and inclusion within, I would say, within the recent, you know, year or two, because I definitely think when it comes to diversity and inclusion, we have seen a shift even within these last 5 years of focuses of what universities, what groups and education groups want to do. Like, for me, example, like, I think my journey with like diversity and inclusion, I'm putting air quotes because obviously I'm not a certified professional. I'm just a Puerto Rican boy with a lived experience.
Who are very valid. Like, who are very valid. Your lived experience are very valid. That is knowledge. That is wealth.
So in high school, I was a part of the Gay Straight Alliance in my high school, which helps to coordinate something that we call Diversity Day. And I really, like, from the creation of this, you know, I really thought it was problematic that our school was focusing on one day of the year that we were going to come together and talk about diversity issues. You know, it might sound great in initial, you know, PTO meeting or initial Board of Education meeting where it's like, okay, we're addressing diversity this day. But I think the problem I had with it was the way and context that, you know, it was brought up, because it wasn't just, you know, it was some staff that were pushing this initiative of like, let's learn about different cultures. And there were some staff of, you know, it's diversity day. It's sort of like a half a day. You don't have to come in, you know, it's not as structured sort of thing. It's like deterring people. It's like, but what do you mean by you don't have to come in for our diversity day? Like, what do you mean by that? And when you're looking like flash forward to college, like, I think this was the first time that I was learning a lot about myself and my cultural identity. I think when my first year in college, I was able to connect with a lot of people from similar backgrounds to me, similar ethnic backgrounds, similar economic backgrounds, similar everything, where it was a lot different than what I was used to at home.
I was used to. I still live in the north end of Middletown, which is where they have like the poorest, you know, minorities, usually black and brown communities. But I went to a school that was across town. It was Middletown High School, that was filled with people from different aspects of Middletown. And Middletown is very affluent in some areas, very rural in some areas. So it was still pretty diverse and I guess economic and lived experience with them. But still, like in the overall sense, they didn't do, a good job in regards to educating our populations and empowering them. Like, I feel like for me to be 18, 19 years old and learning about, you know, learning about the context of Puerto Rico, or learning about the island and learning about the history about some of these things, like, is disheartening for me. It's like, this is my first experience where it's like, this is how this, you know, this scenario came up. It's not the way, like, it's not, we didn't see no Declaration of Independence is so much innocence with that. It's like, we're seeing when we colonize this land, like, there's so much hidden horrors within it. You know, there's so much hidden horrors of these people that have been erased, these cultures have been erased. It's like really spending the time to really educate yourself. I think in my free time, like, really taking the time to read Taíno artists, Taíno activists, like, read more of their work and try to gain a larger perspective. But I think our current education system doesn't allow for our students to have that. It's always an elective. I think that's my biggest thing. It's like, what are your opinions on that? I think some education systems really opt in for having diversity inclusion as an option, or, you know, these things as like, oh, you want to learn about history of black politics within America, like, this is an elective for this course, or you have to be in Africana studies to take that class. Like, what do you think on that?
No, and that's exactly what I want Osami to move, I mean, you know, away, right? So and what I mean by that is it should be available for everyone, right? I think that it's great that you have taken, I mean, the initiative, and you are, you know, curious, and you are a learner who wants to learn about your history, but it shouldn't be available for everyone, right? That we should have, I mean, a history class that every single, I mean, student who is coming to the university will be learning from, that you don't have to be specifically in that, you know, I'm Latinx, I mean, you know, major or minor, African studies, it's for everyone. And that's what I was referring at the, you know, before, Joe, that the more that we start thinking about this way, so how, what are the pieces that we're missing? Because it's so important that everyone, right, that knows, learns about history, and history from many different voices, because let's call it as is, history has been written, you know, for it, from many different, you know, I mean, perspectives, but we need to bring all of those voices, I mean, to our students. So that's one piece. The second piece, I have seen it. You and I have seen this. When we have students of color who are learning about their own history, who are learning about the Taínos, the Mayans, the Aztecs, their African, I mean, you know, stories, who are learning about what is happening to our, you know, populations here in the United States or in the globe. So transformation happens. That learning is to start to transforming. Why? Because you are seeing yourself in the curriculum. And all of a sudden, you are, wow, I cannot believe that this, you know, this scholar, Stringer, who is an African-American, is talking to me about sense of belonging. Or that Silvia Hurtado is talking to me about sense of belonging in development of cultural identity for Latinx. So I think that that's for us, for you and me, who are, you know, from this specific, you know, ethnic group, we feel empowered, we feel that we belong. But at the same time, I really believe that it will open up the eyes to other students who might not be exposed to that. So I am a big proponent of having classes embedded in the curriculum, that if you're majoring chemistry, so you will be taking this class, right? But really taking it, not because you have to fulfill a requirement. This is part of our culture, right? So this is part of being a Husky. And I think that, I know that to change a culture takes time, but we need to start, I mean, somewhere. And go ahead.
No, setting the precedent for that. I think what you mentioned there, like, education can lead to transformation, you know, that, you know, that growth of what you gain. It's expected when you're gaining a massive amount of knowledge. I think for me, like first semester, you know, I definitely had my own struggles of whether or not I felt like I belonged or not. But I think that was also a motivating moment at that time, because it was like, wow, I don't know how many other people from my area or from realistically from my street, from my neighborhood are working to pursue the same things that I want to do. Working to make a change in some of these communities that like that have to be on a PowerPoint slide to be an example for students to learn. Like, I think time and time again, you know, students are always mixed with these emotions when they come into education. If they walk into luckily now, you know, we're all virtual, but still we're seeing how virtual learning plays a role within our, you know, our students, especially our students of color. I think I've seen plenty of news reports already, like 2, 3, 4 talking about students in elementary school, specifically from Black or Brown, already getting suspended from school, from virtual learning because of something that happened on camera, because they couldn't connect to a meeting, couldn't do this. It's like when you want to address imposter syndrome, it's like, how can you address imposter syndrome when you have these education systems that are always playing into making them not feel like they belong? Like, for example, I went home recently this weekend to go see my family. I got to see my nieces. I'm a big deal. I have many nieces and nephews. So I got to go see my niece. She is 15 years old now. She is a freshman in high school, which is huge. But, you know, it's crazy to think that, you know, a lot of the same experiences that I was feeling at 15 is similar to how she's feeling. You know, we had a conversation of whether or not, like, if she liked fitting into her English class because she didn't feel like she spoke, you know, correctly. Like, she's not bilingual, but she, you know, she may not have the most perfect syntax with her sentences and stuff like that compared to some of her peers. But I think a lot of that was like the early stages of showing that she didn't feel like she belonged or that she wasn't good enough. And that was the time where I kind of had a conversation with her about like my high school experience. I think the biggest thing that I brought up too, with even with that diversity day that I mentioned earlier, with I appeared on a panel my senior year, and I talked about sort of code switching and talked about the notion of you talk white, because growing up I felt that I experienced that a lot of I talk white or I talk a certain way because my grammar and my syntax didn't match up with whatever stereotype that this person had in their head. I remember specifically, it had to be like first through third grade, one of those grades. It was literally, I just remember because it's ingrained into my head. And I got back my reading score from one of our standardized testing, you know, within Connecticut. And I had a high reading score. And I was told by my teacher at the time that I talk well for somebody from my area. And she was in reference to the north end of Middletown, where there's a... And at that point, it was like, I didn't know, like, obviously, I just went by it like normal, but I never realized how much that actually affected me until I was in sophomore year of college, sitting in Perlack, going through your class, wondering like, wow, when I'm like, wow, I'm like, I'm really thinking about like my life at this point. And it's, you know, I really try to mention to her, I was like, there's so much in life where there's going to be so many obstacles. There's going to be so many people thinking you don't belong in a space. But I told her, I was like, that's your cue to take up more space. I said, that's your cue to make sure you show people that you earned your spot to get there, that you're there for a reason. And it's not nobody, no classmate, no teacher is going to be able to take that away from you. And it's weird because it's like, I'm 20 years old trying to have these conversations with, you know, this. I think we talked about it in the class too. It's like me as like a second generation in a way. I'm maybe first generation to college, but my family, like I'm still would be second generation in regards to like my family structure. Like a lot of that is I'm pushing on this next generation to follow my steps. It's not just me for, you know, college. It's not just me for what I'm doing. It's my family. It's my nieces. It's my nephews. I want to make sure that they see me graduate from college. They want to graduate from high school and they want to one up me. They want to go to maybe not a better college, because I don't want to give them like, you know, like that elitist mindset. But like if they want to go to a better college, like I want to make sure that they're setting the goals for themselves and they're able to push themselves to new limits. Like they're always telling me what they want to be, what they want to do. And I think now it's like I was never in a situation where
I think at a young age where I kind of wish I had some of this advice. You know, I wish I was able to have a role model or somebody that was able to let me know, you know, to help me contextualize my feelings in a way, you know, because to define, you know, these experiences to people that, you know, may not experience them is so hard. Because I remember going through, you know, high school, I had, you know, some white friends, and trying to explain, you know, my discontent with some of the, you know, language being used, or, you know, some of the situations like coming up. It's much different than, you know, if I was to go towards one of my Latinx peers who understand, you know, the feeling of having to code switch in a space because you don't feel comfortable, or having to talk a certain way in a space because you want to make sure that you come off more professional because you're from this or so background, or changing your voice when you're on the phone with a medical professional because you want to come off this way. And like, describing that, you know, I think the craziest thing about this is that imposter syndrome offers a unique experience to every single person that, you know, experiences it. And I think that offers the beauty in it, because it allows for not only our Huskies in this sense, you know, but people to connect on it. And I think that's one of the biggest thing, is creating that support group of people that have similar experiences. Not similar, because obviously it's having different experiences is what makes you grow. But having those different experiences, maybe they may not have had the same childhood as you, but, you know, they experience the same type of discrimination within, you know, the education system, which is unfortunate to bond upon, but sometimes it's that's how you grow some of your greatest connections. Over that one bond, you're able to have a friend for life.
No, and I agree with you, and you know how much I'm in these conversations, Joe, because they're so needed. And one of the pieces that I love, I mean, the community culture wealth is because, and I did not write it, everyone, I did not write it, is, I mean, amazing Mexican-American scholar, Tara Yoso. Please Google her. She's amazing. And Tara was the one who created, I mean, this community wealth. And it has definitely amplified the voices of many scholars of color, but certainly, you know, like, I mean, our students of color. But one of the pieces that really resonated with me from her model is not working from a deficit model. And I think that what breaks my heart to this day in my years of living in the United States is how our education system, K-12 and, you know, K-16, right? If, you know, even talking about college, there are many different spots where deficit, it's what people are looking at, right? So let's talk about your niece for a moment. And instead of seeing her capacity, this linguistic capital that she can code switch, right? So what is the, for teachers in the classroom to say, okay, so I have this, and I have all, you know, for the teachers to say, I have this group of students, and let me see, what are they bringing to the table? Because they're already bringing lived experiences. They're already smart. They have been going through a lot of learning already. But instead, right? Instead is, let me see what I can give them and how I can change them. I do believe that education is transformation, but I do believe that learning is what transforms you. And I think that when we start talking about learning, then we're going to be changing even more the way that we approach life and the way that we approach this structured education that we get. So what's the learning that my students are bringing to the table? And I think that if we start, you know, like, I mean, changing those components in the K-12, and mind you, I'm not a K-12 expert. I'm going to continue stick in my area in higher education, and I'm not an expert yet. I'm still learning. But I do believe that the more that we start changing this narrative about seeing things from a deficit perspective into a wealth perspective, things will be better. And that's the work that you have alluded, and I have seen it, and I will continue be seeing in Perlac and in the work that we do at the Culture Center, because we believe that you all, right? So our self-identified Latinx students are bringing learning, and that's what I love. It's always great to open up, I mean, this path to you all. That's what college is supposed to be, right? So that we can expand enhance your learning, but at the same time, it's also acknowledging that all of, you know, these incoming Huskies are bringing experiences with them, and they're also bringing this learning, and how can we, you know, expand on that. And that's, for me, that's another goal, that's another purpose to, you know, that I want to be part of this, right? Part of this movimiento of really creating, I mean, this transformation through learning for all of our students. We need to change, Joe, how higher education has been operating for centuries in this country.
For centuries, especially when you look at like predominantly white institutions, you have, this is like the petri dish. I use that example a lot. Like, it's like the research sample for all of these studies of how you feel sense of belonging. If you look at a population like UConn, it's spread out enough where you're able to kind of gauge, especially with the PWI, you're kind of able to gauge these experiences and like contextualize a lot of the experiences, because when you're in a PWI, you have a outbreak of like different racial minority ethnic groups that all face similar experiences just in their own realms, whether that be, you know, our Asian American students experiencing xenophobia at the heightened time of the pandemic, or we're looking at how we were supporting our, you know, our Latinx communities last year after 2 years ago after the Halloween incident where somebody dressed up as an ICE detention officer and we had to be having those conversations. It's like time and time again, it's like we're always expected. When I say we're always, I want to be in reference to the marginalized groups or like the cultural centers in the sense we're always expected to be the ones to respond. And it's never the institution. It's like, I want to say, like, I see the cultural centers as a part of the Huskies or as a part of the student community, because it's like they play their role actively within our community. They are an institution, but I don't see them as, you know, as an office, like the bursar's office or like something that's, you know, very, very, it's not like the dean's office where I'm going to go in there and like, it's completely different. This is an office that's actively engaging with students, that knows how students feels, unlike any other group. And if anything, they know how our marginalized groups feel more than our higher ups, than our president, than these people know. And it's crazy to think that, like, the way, like, after time and time again, you know, every situation, it's always up to the cultural centers. It's always up to our educators, who are always having these conversations. They're always having the conversations of implicit bias. They're always having the conversations of, again, imposter syndrome. Like, I'm glad I got to have you today too, because it's like, well, I love to talk about this too, but it's like, how many times do our professionals who are brought into the university to talk about diversity and inclusion, how much does our predominantly white or our larger institutions exhaust them until they look at new resources? You know, it's very unfortunate. Like, even looking at it for me, like looking at the vigil that was recently hosted, the vigil that was supposed to be put on by the Office of Diversity and Inclusion. And then you see the people that are running it are from the people from the African-American Cultural Center. And now that's, I think that's great. But I think in the same sense, it's like when you said that this event was going to be run by the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, and then your first choice for that event was to go towards the same cultural center that has been exhausted from having these conversations year after year after year, and you're not showing that you're doing anything. I think it's great to have that partnership, but, you know, for me, that was something that really stuck out to me after a conversation I had with a couple of peers, because it's like they mentioned that to me. I didn't notice it my first time. I did not notice that this event was hosted, you know, by the African American Cultural Center at the time. But it's like, you see that, it's like, wow, like these institutions are always exhausting their cultural resources. So it's no wonder why they can feel like they don't feel like they belong, or they may not feel good enough as compared to their white counterparts. So I think we kind of alluded to this for the, you know, for the entirety of the thing. I think we can both agree education plays a unique role in the way that it amplifies imposter syndrome. But I would just wanted to ask you, what advice would you have for students that are, you know, may feel like they don't belong, and educators that could be like educators who may be going into the field and they don't belong, or how they can help our students feel like they belong on a campus.
Yes. No, thank you, Joe. I think that, yes. So one of the pieces that I want to add is, believe it or not, I mean, our faculty and staff also suffer of imposter syndrome. And I think that that's why sense of belonging is so important, right? So sense of belonging is a human need, like similar way that when we eat, when we go to sleep, when we want to dance, it's part of who we are. And I think that for the students, right? So you asked me, I mean, for the students or for whoever is listening or is going to be listening to this podcast, I just wanted to tell you this. You are loved. You matter. You are who you are with all of the gifts that the universe has given you. Do not ever apologize for being you. Find out, I mean, your voice. Amplify your voice. I want you to find one person that you think that can be that person that you're going to be trusting, that the person is going to be helping you. Just find one person and then have that conversation and really find people that will be there for you. And if you are wondering, oh my God, Fanny, where am I going to find this person? So come to us. Come on into, you know, the Puerto Rican Army Culture Center. Come on into the Culture Centers first or any other place that you feel that this person is going to be listening to you. But do not ever compromise your existence. You use your hands when you speak. You have an accent. You speak two languages. You use code switching. Continue being you. Do not ever compromise for anyone. So change will come. All of us will change. I'm not the same. I mean, Fanny, when I came to the U.S., thank God, I mean, for my rose cream, because, you know, that way I can hide my wrinkles. But at the same time, I still remain loyal to me, to the Fanny that I was born to be. So, and that's my message, I mean, for the students. My goal, like I mentioned it at the beginning of this amazing conversation, my purpose in higher education is to continue being an agent of change, that I can be part of something big. My dream is that wherever I am, whether it's at the University of Connecticut or any other place or any other university, that I want to hear from our underrepresented students and students with social identity saying, wow, I do belong at that university. And also feeling that I was switching back and forth. I was doing so many different things. And that college administrator loved me for who I am. And when I started hearing these things, that's when I know that change is happening. So we'll see. I wanna remain optimistic that we're gonna be seeing this change. But you said something, Joe, that resonated with me. I think the culture centers, and specifically at the University of Connecticut, at the Storrs campus, we have built so much love and trust. And to that trust, into that love, I honor them, because I think it's something very precious. And that's what you always see us at the front line. But at the same time, you are absolutely right. It can be very emotional labor, exhausting. And we need, these are the times where we need the rest of the community coming together to keep working, I mean, you know, with us, for our students. So I think that the more that we can start going back to my question, this question of who am I missing at the table? What am I doing for our students of color? What stories am I listening from our students of color? And what stories am I listening? I'm not listening from, you know, from our students as well. And I think that imposter syndrome and sense of belonging is needed for every single college student, but certainly is more prevalent for our students of color. And I will stop there, because I don't want to take so much space.
No, please take up as much space as you want, please. I really hope that we all can take away something from what Fanny said of never compromising who you are. Just make sure you stay as true to yourself as you can and focus on building relationships with people that will support you for you. When you're around people that are like you, you're able to remember that you do have a seat at the table and you do in fact belong. I really urge you all to, you know, try to reach out to someone that you haven't into, you know, in a bit. Check in on them and catch up. Thank you again for Fani for joining me today. As always, if any of you have questions, comments, or would like to be a guest on the show, you can email me at inthemiddleofsomewhere1@gmail.com. Until next time, take care.